Hey friends, you're listening to Changing the Conversation, a podcast by African Leadership and the Mocha Club, where we take time to sit down and explore topics to challenge our perspective in pursuit of better loving people and the world around us. I am so excited for today's podcast. You guys get to meet one of my dearest friends, Peter Ochiel. He is a leader and pastor over in Kenya. And our Mocha Club Journey team just took a trip over there to visit him and his students and just the cutest little kids you've ever seen. But his story is just amazing on how he got called into ministry and how he serves a leprosy community now in Kenya, which is pretty incredible. So I'm really excited for you to meet him and hear his story. Emily will also be joining us in on this conversation. But just to warn you, this conversation is a little longer. Peter's story is just so incredible that we don't want to cut anything out because we want you to hear every single piece of it. So grab a cup of coffee, put your feet up, relax, and enjoy our conversation with Peter Ochiel.
Today on the podcast, Fallon and I are going to be speaking with Peter Ochiel from Mombasa, Kenya, about how the circumstances and the stories of our life leave such a strong imprint on who we are, and they change often the trajectory or give the why and the meaning and the purpose to the trajectory of our life.
Welcome to Changing the Conversation.
Welcome. Welcome, Peter.
Thank you very much.
Peter, we're so glad you're here.
Asante. I'm glad to be here too.
Asante sana.
Karibu.
Karibu.
Karibu sana.
Awesome.
Someday, let's do an entire podcast in Swahili.
That's what he said he was going to do. He's like, great, we're doing a podcast all in Kiswahili. Perfect.
Tuko hapa pamoja na Emily na Fallon, tunazungumzia kuhusu kubadilisha mazungumzo.
And what's the title of our podcast?
Kubadilisha mazungumzo.
Sounds good to me.
Sounds like Changing the Conversation. Fallon, talk to me a little bit about what life was like for you growing up in Michigan.
Peter, did you know I'm from Michigan?
I do know.
So I'm from Michigan, St. Joseph, Michigan, which is in the southwest corner of the state, right on the lake. Have you been to a great lake, Peter?
Lake Victoria.
Yeah.
Which is a great lake, but not in the U.S.
Right. Not one of the greats.
Said like an American.
So growing up, my family were big travelers. They really saw the benefit and the value of learning about the world around you. So we traveled all over the United States. We traveled outside the states. I went to Israel when I was 8 years old.
Wow.
Which was just one of the most unbelievable experiences, even as an 8-year-old. Yeah, just traveled everywhere. And so I think growing up in a family that traveled a lot, I was given the great opportunity to just see beyond my own little world and see that there was a world beyond myself and other cultures and beliefs and traditions. And so I felt very lucky growing up.
How did that experience of travel and your family's kind of propensity towards it, how did that shape you as you aged and went through high school and into college?
Yeah, I think I, just like they did, saw value in learning about other people besides myself for different lifestyles besides my own. And so I continued to desire that knowledge, wanted to learn more about other places and people that I hadn't been to before, and not only wanting to know about them, but knowing that there's an intrinsic value to them and where they live, and wanting to honor that by knowing and being a part of someone else's life that looked different than my own.
And then in college, you were made aware, introduced to the Mocha Club.
Yeah, in college, I traveled a little bit, went on some trips outside the U.S. to serve. Went to Jamaica once to serve at a deaf school, which was really sweet. Got to learn sign language and just learn a whole new world of communicating with people that couldn't hear. So that was a really beautiful experience. And then that kind of reignited my passion to learn about other cultures and be a part of something beyond myself. And so I had been looking for more service opportunities or organizations that worked throughout the world that I could become a part of that would continue that journey of loving other people and learning about other people. So I heard about the Mocha Club, which was crazy. I wasn't expecting to learn about them because I was a Friday night and I went to a show with some friends. And the artist started talking about Mocha Club. And at that point, they were asking for $7 a month to help families all over the continent of Africa receive healthcare. And for me as a college student, I had $7. And so I felt like the Lord was opening a seat at the table saying, I see your desire. I know your desire to help others and want to learn about others and be part of others' lives. So what about this? So it felt very intentional from the Lord to open that opportunity up for me.
That's amazing. So Fallon, this experience you've had of travel, it kind of started and formed really early in your life. And God's done some pretty amazing work in and through that.
Oh, yeah. He just took those early experiences and then those desires that built up because of that and just kind of formed my life around that, which is pretty incredible. I feel very lucky, very privileged to be able to live a life that feels bigger than given my own vices, I would make it all about me, and that's not what it's all about.
I think that's what I love about people's stories is that so often in the moment, a circumstance might be lovely. It might be the middle of Israel and you're 8 years old and there's joy and there's friendship that's forming. And some of the circumstances that we find ourselves in aren't lovely and are harder and more challenging and they're frustrating and they come with emotions and experiences that are far more painful and not as pleasant. But God finds this beautiful way of weaving those things together to tell a much grander story. And it's often in those harder moments, it's in those early childhood experiences that He's actually imprinting on our hearts and on our being the story that He's crafting and inviting us into. And what God did for you in early childhood memories of travel and movement with family and joy ignited and fostered this deep curiosity and love and a sense of purpose in meeting and interacting with men and women all over the world. And it literally shaped what you responded to on a Friday night years later and has shaped your forward progress to date, the woman that you are at 30 and the life that you are giving. I mean, you just got back from Africa. It was all shaped by those early fingerprints that He put on your family. It doesn't just happen for you or for me. It happens for Peter in Kenya. So Peter, your story is radically different from Fallon's. Can you paint us a picture of what life was like for you as an 8-year-old in Kenya? What does your family look like? What does your home look like? What does early childhood look like for you?
Well, thank you so much. As an 8-year-old, we lived in a very remote, deep village in Western Kenya. And our family then had one hut where we all live together, my dad, mom, and my siblings. Yeah, it was just fun. But here we had a family of five living in this one room. And we had everything there. We called it a self-contained room because it had the bedroom, sitting room. Everything was in there. Our roof was made out of grass. And whenever it rains a lot in Western Kenya. Whenever it rained, it was leaking, so it was the same. It was raining outside and it was raining inside as well. But we were happy. We were very happy and we enjoyed life and praised God and yeah.
So you're growing up in a one-room hut with your two siblings and your parents. And you're in school. What does your day look like as an 8-year-old? What's happening?
Well, I went to school about 1.5 mile away from home. Mm-hmm. We had to walk to school barefooted, no shoes. And we had to walk to school in the morning. So we reported to school as early as 7:30 in the morning. Mm-hmm. And remember, this place was bushy and there were no proper roads. But we used to walk in groups with other children from the neighbors, walking to school in the morning, sitting in school up to 12:30, and then we could break up again, run home for lunch.
Literally run home?
Yeah, literally run home. Wow. Because we had to come back to school on time. Wow. So if we left for lunch at 12:30, we needed to be back in school, say, at 1:30. So you needed to maximize the time that you have. Run, eat quickly, and then literally run back to school. Mm. And school is where there was only one borehole in the village. Mm-hmm. And it was drilled at the school. So whenever you were going to school, you also carried a 10-liter jerrycan of water. Mm. And so, which meant you are coming back home with water.
So you're walking 7:30 in the morning, group of kids, a mile and a half, mm-hmm. barefoot to school with a jerry can, mm-hmm. an empty jerry can. Mm-hmm. And when you're leaving for lunch break, you're running back with a full jerry can mm-hmm. full of water, mm-hmm. dropping it for mom,
yes.
eating real quick,
yes.
running back for mm-hmm. school.
Yeah.
What was your overwhelming sense as a child? Were you aware that life was hard or trying, or was there a sense of... You mentioned laughter and joy. How did you feel as an 8-year-old?
I felt very happy.
Yeah.
That's the life we knew.
Right.
I mean, we didn't even realize that we were poor or going through difficulties. That was life. And we just enjoyed walking to school and carrying the water. Of course, there's a time you were tired and hungry and sweating or cold.
You're an 8-year-old.
Yeah, but then... that was life, and we had loving parents, and it was good to be in school, and we were told going to school kind of was an assurance of a brighter future. Mm-hmm. And so we looked forward to that future. We looked forward to a day that we will possibly graduate from school and be a teacher or be a preacher, be someone in the community.
Wow. Were you good in school? Did you get high marks, high grades?
Yes, I did. When I eventually did my class 8, and at some point we moved from having one hut to a smaller hut that was built. And by this time, God had been gracious to our family, blessed us with one cow that we were given by a neighbor. And so spent the rest of my upper primary school living in this smaller hut. That's where I spent the night. I shared this hut with the cow.
You and the cow, roomies.
Yes, me and the cow. And whenever the cow went for a short call at night, I always had to wake up because it splashed all over, you know.
Oh,
again.
Man. Wow. That was not my middle school experience.
Sure. Yeah. So anyway, I was able to go through and got very high marks in my class 8. I was one of the best students and passed for high school. But there's a chance that I was going to miss. I was going to miss going to high school. High school opened a lot of opportunities. You are going to leave home, go to a nice boarding school where there's going to be a bed, there's going to be a mattress, there's going to be electricity for the first time. I mean, it was a whole different life. And when you went to high school, you went to another status altogether. But because of lack of money, I was going to miss this opportunity of high school. I actually did miss the boarding school. But my parents and my community members came together and they raised money. And people donated clothes. And they were basically old clothes, old books, and pairs of shoes that other farmers had been using. They gave it to me, and I was able to eventually report to a day school. This day school was about 2.5 miles from home, and that meant, again, walking to school in the morning at the 2.5 miles and walking back in the evening.
Wow.
your whole life trajectory kind of formed pretty early. Your parents built a life that explained and pointed out the value of education, that education was a way for you to have a bigger, brighter future than what your parents had known. Because your parents were illiterate, correct?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So they saw this opportunity for school to add so much value and craft for you a future that they couldn't give you otherwise.
Mm-hmm.
You are, God gifted you with a really incredibly smart brain. He grew your family's status in the community. You were able to build a second hut. You kind of moved out from home, right? Middle
mm-hmm,
schooler
mm-hmm.
out on his own in the hut with the cow.
Mm-hmm.
And then you graduated. You graduated with high marks. You are looking towards this brighter future. And the reality is there's not enough money.
Yeah. The truth is my parents valued education, but one thing they valued most was God.
Mm-hmm.
And so very early in life, they taught me, and not only taught me, but I also learned from them the fear of God. And that the fear of God was the beginning of wisdom, and that if you had faith, God was able to open doors for you and things were able to work. And then you need to go to school, you need to have an education and do your best. And so I go to high school, and those were 4 years. Now I'm a teenager. Well, in high school, and so I'm learning more things. But those were 4 years that were not easy. It was tough because I want to be in school, but there's no school fee. They paid less, so you are chased away from school. You have to be out of school for weeks sometimes or for days, or to devise ways of staying in school and kind of beating the system just for you to be able to get the education.
So your parents couldn't afford to send you to the high school. You had to pay to go to high school, and you had to be in proper uniform. So you had two kind of things standing in your way. You needed money to pay,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
and then you needed a full dress uniform.
Mm-hmm.
How did God provide for your school fees?
Well, God provided for me school fee in amazing ways. One is that the fee was never paid in full. I paid a little bit here and a little bit there. And so that meant that you are not in school all the time,
mm-hmm.
because the roll call will be done. The clerks or the accountants will come to the classroom, read the list of people who had paid, and you could be asked to kindly go home and get money before mm-hmm. you are admitted in.
But how did God supply the money?
The members of my community came together. That was the most beautiful part of it. That's the part that changed my life. That these people who are just like us, and maybe some even worse than us, could come together and contribute the small amount of money they had, or give school items like books or just the clothes that resembled our uniform, gave it to me so that I could go to school and be able to sit in class. So that's how God really provided. It was through the community. It was through the church that we attended.
That experience has shaped your understanding of value and community. I mean, it is literally how you became the man that you are, is that an entire group of people believed confidently that God had given you a gift and that they could add to your life, that they could leverage who they were and what they had.
Yes, I grew up, and especially in those days in high school, I looked at the community where I lived, and I looked at generations that were going to come after me. And I said, I may not affect everybody, but I want to grow up. I want to be a blessing to other families. I want to be a blessing to other children who will be going through the same life I'm going through, and in whatever way, make them better.
Mm-hmm.
If possible, make them stay in school with a school uniform. If possible, enable them to be in school without having to miss classes,
mm-hmm.
without having to go to the dustbin to look for used socks and other items thrown away by other children.
Yeah, tell me about that. So the community is rallying. They're helping pay for school fees. They're bringing you old books. Mm. They're helping get you your trousers. Mm. But there were some pretty lean times in there. There was a day that you didn't have socks. So tell me about that day.
Sure. There were actually days. There were many days. And so for me to be able to sit in class, and because I need to be in this school uniform, it's a qualification for me to be in class, I go to the dustbin, I go to the garbage pit, and I scavenge through looking for anything that have been thrown away by other children. We had other children who came from well-off families, but they were really old. I mean, So I get these pieces of socks that do not have the bottom at all.
No toes.
No toes, yeah. They do not have the toes, and I just... it's just hanging on my legs to show. And actually, I think throughout my high school, it might have only been once that I had shoes that had the proper soles.
You just had the ankle part.
Yeah.
I mean, you were just literally taking the tube part of the sock that's around your ankle and shoving it in at the top of your shoe.
Yes.
So it looks like you're wearing a sock.
Looks like, but it's not. It's but not. Wow. Yeah. You could not remove it where people are.
But it was all the asset that you needed to be able to stay in school.
Yes, it was all the asset that I needed to be able to stay in school. And I did stay, by God's grace.
Your story has always been really profound to me because it brings together kind of the harmony of how your life and your family circumstances can create such a strong sense of direction, and then how God brings all the additional pieces into being just when they're necessary.
Mm.
We talked last night about 2 Peter 1:3, that God says he's given us everything we need for life and godliness. And I oftentimes am not confident that that's true, especially when I'm in Africa. It's easy to look around the room. I mean, Fallon, you were just there.
Mm-hmm.
It's easy to look at the circumstances of what you see and think, man, God forgot to leave the things that this community needed.
When Peter was talking, I thought it reminds me of the phrase that comparison is the thief of joy. Because what Peter knew as an 8-year-old was all he needed to know to be joyful. He didn't need to compare to the world around him. And that's what kept his family so loving and joyful together, and that's all they needed. So I think that is true, that the Lord gives us all we need to realize that we can have joy with what we have. And I can get lost in the world saying, oh, you need this shiny thing and that shiny thing and this much amount of money in your bank account. But it's not true. It just isn't true. And I've learned that by seeing the world around me that lives the most joyful lives that I've ever seen with what they have that is so simple.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Fallon, like you just so eloquently said, everything Peter and his family needed for a joyful life, God provided at 8.
Mm.
And yet God knew the story he was writing for Peter and all the things he was going to craft for Peter to be a part of, all of the ways he was going to invite Peter in his future as an adult to participate with what God was doing in a totally different part of the country. And so in the crafting from this 8-year-old version to this adult version of Peter, he brought the pieces that you needed when you needed them. Mm-hmm. He brought a community to bring pieces of school fees. Mm-hmm. He brought what other people considered garbage, and they had thrown out these holy socks. He redeemed and gave to you. It was all the sock you needed to pass and qualify and get through school. Mm-hmm. Those things have shaped the man you have become.
Mm.
Yeah. And I also have to say that whereas we were joyful and happy, but there were those painful moments. There were those painful moments when you have to walk away from school when people are in class because you've not paid your fee. And you know it's not your fault, but it's also not your parents' fault because they don't have and they're doing their best. There are those painful moments when you know you have to walk to school 2 or 3 miles in the morning and in the evening. And sometimes you missed your lunch because there's not enough finances to take you to the boarding school. where you qualified to be. And when you walked in the rain, when it rained on you all the way to school and back, or the hot sun and the dust. But those painful moments were not as strong as the future that God was showing me, and the future of other generations that will be better, that will be joyful because of those moments.
What were you thinking and feeling in those moments, in those painful moments? You're walking to school in the rain, and you qualified for a much better school where you would not be walking. You would be living there. Mm-hmm. And God didn't give you that. He said no to a boarding school. What are you thinking as you're walking in the rain to school? How are you feeling?
I was feeling that even walking in the rain was a privilege, because even that I was going to miss. Were it not for God providing for that. So even for the opportunity to be able to be in that day school was an opportunity that I would have missed if it were not of God. And I was thinking also, God was speaking to me about the future, that the future will be different, not only for me, but for others.
I think it's really hard for me often to live in the tension in those moments. There is often a tension that exists between knowing that what I have and what I've been given and the circumstances that I find myself in, God designed this moment and for me to be in this moment. And because He designed it, I fully trust that it is good. Mm-hmm. And yet there's a tension of, I don't want this moment. Mm-hmm. I don't want to be in the rain. I don't want to be in this kind of pain. It's hard to hold both of those things as truth, that I can bring all of the pain of the moment and also all of the truth and the faith that says, God gave me this. You're walking in that moment and recognizing that there are plenty of things that are hard about the moment, but there's also a lot to be joyful of, that this day school is exactly mm-hmm. what God gave you. And He could have not even given you that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Do you still have moments like that?
Yes, I do. I have plenty of them.
Do you want to tell me about one of them?
Plenty of them. And they're all different. I mean, they're all personal times when I'm not able to provide for my family some things that are essential. Mm-hmm. I just have to trust God that God will be able to make a way for the family. And that's my own family, my children, my wife sometimes. And then there are all these people who come to me. And like I was saying, just before I traveled here, the last week before I came, I had called some of the children that we support in high school. I needed to see their report forms and to get a picture of them. Mm-hmm. And there was this young man who came, who actually represents so many others. Mm-hmm. And he came to me and said, Peter, have not been in school for the last semester, and please don't leave me behind when you are helping these others. I also want to go back. I want to be in school. I want my education. And those are painful moments, especially when you want to assist, but you don't have the resources to assist. It's, how do you say goodbye to that young man? How do I leave him? Mm-hmm. So, yes, I still have those painful moments.
What are you holding on to in that moment? When you tell that boy no, how did you respond to him?
Well, I told him, I understand your situation. Let's believe God. God is able to provide. Have faith and don't give up.
And you get to say that with full faith and confidence because it was true for you.
Yes, I know it's possible. I know that God
You know exactly what He feels like.
Mm-hmm. I know exactly what He feels like. I mean, I know exactly. And I can see it on His face, and I can see it in His dedication. I can see it. Mm-hmm. But God gives us grace. But it's not easy.
No.
Yes. It's not.
It's not easy. Mm-hmm. It's interesting to me that God puts you in circumstances. He puts all of us in circumstances that He uniquely designed us to be able to carry. I mean, you can respond to that boy in a way that I could not have responded. My pride, My drive to be the savior and the hero in that moment would have easily caused me to figure out how to do it. And you entered into that boy's story exactly how God wanted you to enter into it.
Yeah, and talking about painful moments, there have been several. I've walked into sick, dying people, and I've literally carried people to the hospital and just see people, precious people, losing their lives because they didn't have access to medication, basic health care that would have saved their lives. And they look at you and you see a life going. Sometimes the only thing I can do when it's too late is to lead them to Jesus. Just lead them to Christ and kind of say goodbye. But the good thing is when you carry them to the hospital, for instance, you see a hope and a radiance, even in their dying faces. I had such an experience early this year. And this lady had been home, bedridden, and there was totally no hope for her. There was no one to take her to hospital. There was no way she was receiving primary health care. And I ran into her heart in this village, and I couldn't believe it when I saw her. And I asked her, "Do you want to go to the hospital?" She said yes. I said, "Can we go right away?" She said yes. So carried her to the hospital, and before I did that, I asked her, "Do you want to give your life to Jesus?" She said yes. So I led her to Jesus, to the Lord, and carried her to the hospital and left her there with her family. And the next day I went to visit her, and she had got some medication, and she was better, and I went and she smiled, and her face had just changed. There was a radiance, there was a joy in her face that was not there the day before. And so we talked briefly with her. I asked her what she wanted. She told me she wanted some drinks, and then I said goodbye. And the next day in the morning, I got a report that she'd gone to be with the Lord.
Mm-hmm.
And this was not an old person. This was someone in her 30s. You see a life that is cut short. It's painful. But again, the joy that at least she was able to be ministered to in the last minute of her life, in the last days of her life, also brings joy. So just to say that these painful moments, we go through them in different ways, with children who need to go to school, with families who are hungry and do not have food, and also with people who just need Jesus. The enemy have blinded their eyes. Some of them were born Muslims and they are lost. They just need Jesus and they haven't opened their hearts yet to the saving grace of the Lord.
It's a really hard thing to say and believe that the Lord is using all circumstances to draw us to Him, that He's using all of these circumstances of our life, the pleasant, joyful ones and the painful ones, to craft a very specific purpose for who we are meant to be and how He is inviting us to take all of who He's made us to be and shaped us to be to leverage that for other people. You took your story of your early childhood and watching this community rally and being given everything you needed only in the moment that you needed it, to graduate from high school, and then to take all of that story and propel you into your future. You made it from a rural village with a small hut that you shared with a cow, and you landed in Mombasa, Kenya, which is the port. It's radically different from this village that you were raised in. And you crafted a vision for how you could use all of your life and the story of your life to have impact and be a blessing to the people that God brought to your life, just like your community had been a blessing to you. So tell me a little bit about the community. You met this beggar in Mombasa, Kenya, and the community you ended up in.
Yes. So after I finished my high school, I stayed home for a while and then came to Mombasa, the big city. this was a radical change from what life was in the village and our small markets in the village. Mm-hmm. It was huge. It was touristic. Lots of white people. You rarely see white people in the village.
Mm-hmm.
In Kenya, lots of white people and lots of luxuries, tall buildings.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it was kind of the place to be. But also, coupled with all these things, in the midst of all these luxuries, we came face to face with slums for the first time in my life. People living without drainage, without, it was just terrible living conditions. People living in the streets, street boys, street girls, and street families, and beggars. And that was not an easy sight to behold. But the Lord has been speaking to me and the circumstances of my high school, and the Lord gave me a vision to reach people with the love of Christ and mercy ministry, and that is to help people, disparate families, people living in the slums, orphans, widows, children who are not able to go to school. It was just a vision, something that was in me. And so one day, while I'm in the city of Mombasa, I met with this old man begging. And he comes to me and he says, "Hey, could you help me take my children to school?" And when he asked me if I could help him to pay the fee for his two children, that is something that resonates with me. I remember my days in school and all the struggles. And I think about those children. And I did take a step of faith, because it's not that I had money or a fund somewhere or donors to come along me. But I decided to make a visit and to go and see these children. I thought it was close by, but this visit took me again from the city back into a village about 30 miles away from the big city. This was a remote village, and so I go, I found these children in school, and they were really in need. They didn't have books, they didn't have uniform. It was something I was familiar with. And after that, I told them to take me home. And when I went home, that walk changed my life. I found this village with people who are disabled, disfigured. Most of them were amputated in their legs or hands. I thought, this is strange. This is something that is not right here. And also, the people were running away from me. They were not welcoming, and they were surprised I was there. But then I discovered that I was in a leprosy village. I was in a village with people who had suffered from leprosy, and they were rejected. As a matter of fact, I discovered the old man I'd met in the city was one of the leprosy victims. And although they did not have leprosy anymore, but they had the effects of the disease, and they had lived on rejection. They had lived with the rejection the whole of their lives. The name of their village was known as Tumbe, which meant a place for rejected people, a camp for rejected people.
So you follow this man home because he says, "Help me get school fees for my kids." And yes, that resonates with you.
Yes.
And home is a camp for people who have had leprosy.
Mm.
So there's this leprosy hospital near the camp, correct?
Mm-hmm.
And they treated the leprosy victims. And when they left the hospital, now free of leprosy, they couldn't really return home. They've been stigmatized. They're rejected.
They actually, most of them did return home.
Okay.
But because of rejection at home, they came back.
They came back. Mm-hmm. So they try to go back to life as normal. They can't go back to life as normal.
Mm.
They kind of start creating this own little camp near the hospital just for rejected people who are no longer welcome because at some point they had leprosy.
Yes.
But a lot of these people that live in rejected camp have a lot of the effects of leprosy. You said they've been amputated or they have wounds that are still healing.
Recurrent, yes.
And they build a life for themselves in this camp.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
2-3 generations of people.
Yes.
So the kids that are running around this camp, like this beggar's kids, do they have leprosy?
No, they don't have. Okay. The kids don't have leprosy.
They don't have leprosy. They're perfectly healthy, but they're living...
Yeah, they don't have physical leprosy, that's what I said.
Okay.
But they have it in their mind.
They have it in their mind.
Mm.
They're living with the same kind of stigma,
yes,
that they're rejected, that they don't have value,
yeah,
that they're unwanted in the larger community.
Mm.
Okay. So you enter in, and what do you decide to do about it?
Well, I enter in, and God speaks to me and tells me, I've sent you here, and I want you to work with these people. And the first thing I want you to do is to change the name. Change it from Rejected Camp, Rejected Village. Call it Blessed Camp. And start telling these people that they are special, they are blessed, they are worthy, they are loved, they are not a rejected people. That's exactly what I start to do. Start sharing with them the love of God, telling them that they are special, they are loved. Although they have leprosy, they had leprosy, but that does not define them.
Mm-hmm.
And I see all these children who don't have education. In three generations, I find out that only one boy has been to high school. The rest have not. No girl has been to eighth grade. And it really moves my heart. And so under this tree where we meet for sharing the word of God in the weekdays, we meet in the same place with these children.
Mm-hmm.
And we start teaching them basic education. Start teaching them to read and to write and to hold a pen. And our first books was actually the ground.
You were writing on the ground.
On the ground, yes.
Yeah. So you started doing this work in 2004?
Yeah.
Since then, what have you created? What is Action Ministries doing at Blessed Camp?
Well, we began under the tree where we teach the children, and under the tree where we also dress the wounds of the people. We called it the Hospital Without Borders. So we dress the wounds of the leprosy victims, and we also do jigger treatment and eradication, and we cook food and distribute it. And so we began small, and we began by faith. And we began because we had the heart, the passion, the drive. It was a calling from God. And because for the first time, the leprosy people and families that had been rejected all their lives find the people that love them, find the people that care for them. And we also find very rich and deep fellowship with them. They start sharing their stories and their lives. And we start talking and sharing ours. And so, slowly, small steps, we've been able to build a school, Blessed Camp, where the children now go to. The church is reaching not only the leprosy people, but also the entire community, same as the school. Our clinic that began under the tree without boundaries now has a building. It still has no boundaries. It reaches out to the entire community. But it's been registered now by the government, and we have qualified people working in it.
Fallon, so this is where your guys' stories collide, because you just got to go see Peter and be at Blessed Camp. Paint a picture of what you walked into.
Wow. I walked into a place that was just so full of the joy and the love that Peter has described that he had in his family growing up. We literally opened the van door and kids just swarmed our vehicle and grabbed our hands and pulled us to the playground and laughed. And it was like coming home. It was coming home. And it was an honor to get to continue the work that Peter has done since 2004, which is just love on these people and let them know that they're loved. Peter, for years, has been telling people that they are children of God and daughters of God, and we just got to say the same thing with our actions, with our handholds and our hugs and our just time spent with them. And so it really was, I felt walking in, I knew I was in a very privileged place to be able to walk into that village and just be with these people. It felt like an honor. It really did. It felt like a sacred thing we got to be a part of.
Was there hard? Is there still hard at Blessed Camp?
In my mind, rectifying my world in another world that I just saw, that's hard to kind of understand or comprehend or put to rest that that's reality. Not because I think my way of life should be their way of life, but just understanding how the Lord places us in different areas of the world and says, this is the life I have for you and this is the life I have for these people. At the same time, there's this intense peace and understanding that the Lord's love and protection and purpose in our lives is all the same. That he puts us in places where at the end of the day, he's going to be glorified. And it can look like a camp in the middle of Kenya, and it can look like a bustling town in the middle of Tennessee. And at the end of the day, the Lord will get the glory as he should.
They're still hard in Mombasa. Absolutely. There's still jiggers and parasites. There's still people dying.
Yeah.
Is there laughter and joy?
So much.
A lot of it.
I mean, video after picture after video. Yes, there's so much joy. And I would say we might look at Blessed Camp and see the hardships physically. Mm. But I would say my world reflects that same hardship emotionally and mentally. Mm-hmm. There's hard in all our lives. It just may look a little different in a different capacity.
And there's good in all of our lives.
Absolutely.
Yeah. I think that's what I love about when we, and we say this all the time, but when we spend time with one another, what I love is the place where we can recognize our humanness, our shared humanness, that we are united in both our brokenness and in our value, that there is both hard and pain and joy, and no one's life is void of having both. There's always a tension that we live in, we will live in this world, of carrying both. And yet, the beauty of your guys' stories is that Fallon, in those moments of joy as an 8-year-old running around in Israel and building new lifelong relationships, God was imprinting on you something that he was going to use for your whole life. And in the moments, Peter, of walking to school in the rain, unsure of how you were going to afford to continue, he was still using that circumstance as an imprint on who you are. And forming who you are going to be. And we need both. Fallon, you've had plenty of hard. And Peter, you've had plenty of joy. Both of your stories carry pain and joy that when mashed together in the unique way that God is writing your story, it's what he's using to create and craft a being that displays, Fallon, as you said, displays his glory. In a unique way. And I think it's beautiful.
Yeah.
Asante sana, right?
Hakuna
Matata. We hold it all.
Thank you. Hakuna Matata.
Hakuna Matata. Hold it all. And then don't worry and stress about it. So I think what I would want our listener to take away from today is that regardless of where your day might have you, either in the pain or in the joy, all of these things are being crafted and molded into you for a purpose that you can leverage for something greater than yourself.
Amen.
Amen.